KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Part of the solution has to be increased revenues, particularly in a fair and balanced way, and that the wealthiest Americans have to contribute.
I am absolutely a Democrat. You look at my issues on social issues, I'm about as progressive as anybody in our caucus.
Gay marriage and marijuana, it's not about creating a state for people to go crazy. It's about creating enough space for people to be themselves and enjoy marijuana.
Some of the voices from the week's news: pot and same-sex marriage legal. That was James Beard on marijuana. Rodney Tom on why he really is a Democrat, not a Republican. And Patty Murray talking about that fiscal cliff. And just want to let you know that NPR is covering, as we speak, the elementary school shooting. So we're going to have updates on that through the day. It has been a wild week in the headlines, shooting in Oregon as well. On Sunday, I think at least one of the reporters in this room was at Seattle City Hall, where hundreds of couples got married. It's not unusual for people to get married, but these were hundreds of same-sex couples taking advantage of new rights under Washington state law. Not everybody was thrilled that same-sex marriage was legal in the state, but as far as I know, nobody was at Seattle City Hall protesting what was a day of love and harmony. One big story shaking the rafters to take a look back at the week. Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger, who wrote about this, I think was at Seattle City Hall on Sunday.
That's right, I was.
We'll talk about that. Knut Berger, the Moss back at crosscut.com. Joni Balter, assistant political editor for the Seattle Times. As usual, nice to see you all.
Good morning to you.
Good to see you, Marcy.
Our email is...
See if you can, you know, get us going here today.
whack, whack. I should say the AP is reporting that 27 people were killed in this elementary school shooting in Connecticut.
Lord.
So we'll be updating you. It kind of follows on the heels. Before we talk about the happy news, Oregon, a shooter, a crazed shooter in a shopping mall outside of Portland, and... shot himself, which I believe is what they're talking about with these
shooters. They were talking about in Connecticut, and I don't know who shot who. In Connecticut, there was one gunman that was, shall we say, under control. But what I heard was that the police were going house to house in the neighborhood of the school looking for a possible second gunman. That was confirmed. It wasn't clear for sure that there was a second gunman, but they were sure going house to house to make sure that they knew the answer to the question.
So we're going to find out more about that, and we'll have details as they unfold. Just brings you, sort of stops you in your tracks, because we did start the week on Sunday. Now we'll talk about something that a lot of people were happy about.
It's a hard transition.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. So everybody just take a deep breath here, and then we'll just talk about something that was a long time in coming. Eli, set the scene at City Hall, Seattle City Hall, Sunday.
It was a long time coming, and a hard transition from the news of the shooting.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard the numbers. That's just awful. City Hall, as I wrote about on Sunday, was a rare scene and a rare and wonderful use of the public space down there. The mayor opened up City Hall to gay couples who had gotten their licenses the Wednesday or Thursday morning at, 12:01 a.m. and then waited for the 3-day waiting period. Maybe I can put in here, there's not a waiting period for a lot of weapons, but there is a waiting period to get married.
That's for same-sex and not anybody.
Yeah, so
it's
you
called the cooling-off period, is it not?
Yeah. So after the 3-day waiting period to use their new marriage licenses, a lot of same-sex couples, I think I would say dozens, I don't know whether it was over 100 at the end of the day, came through City Hall and got married in these really beautiful little spaces that were created within the hall by local artists. And McGinn was there, Mayor McGinn, a lot of judges volunteering their time to do it. And then this really beautiful procession down the steps of City Hall afterward, where the couples were announced, and people had just come to cheer and offer flowers. And one couple in particular stuck in my mind. They're on the cover of The Stranger this week, a woman who had been in the Navy and then in the Coast Guard and showed up in her crisp Coast Guard dress blues, and her partner, who showed up in this really wonderful brocaded white dress and kind of classic hat out of I don't know if I'll get the era right, but maybe the 20s. They just looked great. And to see them come down the steps and then walk down the street, it kind of, for me at least, it evoked one of those victory parades after a war is over, you know? And I felt like that a little bit.
My favorite was the name of one of the judges, Mary Yu.
The judges volunteered their time, right?
Yeah, and not only on Sunday, Mary Yu, as Joni was mentioning,
wonderful.
Was the first judge to marry the first same-sex couple in King County at like 12:01 or something a.m. on Sunday morning in the King County courthouse. And the judges responded to what they realized was just this overwhelming demand. There wouldn't be enough slots at City Hall on Sunday, so they opened up the courthouse as well.
Well, the Seattle City Hall and the courthouse were just two sites. People were getting married in many venues, churches, people.
The Yacht Club had some weddings. There were a lot of, you know, actually what I think was interesting is a lot of businesses recognized the impact of same-sex marriage and sort of took advantage of it and you know, staged weddings and were catering to the weddings and every other form of getting involved.
Well, I mean, weddings are business.
They're big business, yes.
And in counties all over the state, I mean, there are a lot of pictures that came out of this, and some of the most moving ones were couples, you know, walking out of the county licensing office in Spokane or in even smaller counties. And you can just kind of see, I felt like you can see in their bearing, you know, an even heavier weight that had hung on them and an even greater sense of relief.
Were there, I mean, I know people were worrying about protesters, but were there any?
No. I was shocked. I think a lot of people were shocked. There were no protesters at City Hall on Sunday, which is maybe, and I wrote about this in this week's Stranger, maybe just another sign of how mainstream this has become.
Well, the Seattle Times ran a story last Saturday by Carol Ostrom that did get into sort of, there is a, you know, you have to, in a state that is divided on some topics, you do have to kind of wonder for a minute, what if you're a voter who didn't want to legalize pot and you're a voter who wasn't for same-sex marriage? You know, how are you feeling about these changes in our state? You know, we are the focus of a lot of national reporting on the fact that we, in the same election, took these two actions. So we ran one of those graphics that kind of shows you county by county. There were 19 counties out of Washington's 39 counties that didn't vote for either. And so that story was just an attempt to give those folks a voice and let them say, you know, this is not, we're not there, but we still live here. And many of them said we accept it. Many of them said otherwise. But, you know, just to capture that.
Well, the Archbishop in Seattle has sent out his formal response, which was that nobody gets married in a Catholic-owned facility, be it a school or a church, and nobody affiliated with the Catholic Church can officiate, right?
Yeah, and in its way, I mean, I think it's a terrible decision, and it will further divide the Catholic Church from its members here in Washington State, but it's also a wonderful illustration of the point that was made repeatedly and was very hard to get through because of the kind of misstatements that the opposition was putting forward. But during the campaign, the point was made repeatedly that this law does not force churches to do anything they don't want to do. So the Catholic Church is absolutely within its rights to make what I think is a terrible decision.
Yeah, I think that was even more underscored the importance of what happened at City Hall, which was the one of the major benefits, of course, of same-sex marriage is all the legal advantages that now people can just have automatically once you get that license and once you tie the knot. And I thought it was really wonderful. I talked to one of the mayor's staffers beforehand, and they were kind of going crazy because they said, you know, We're suddenly planning 140 weddings. You know, that's not exactly what the city government is designed to do. I was amazed. It just seemed like they pulled it off really well. And I noticed in the end, I think it was 138 weddings.
Yes, it was.
I was wondering if two couples got cold feet, which is also part of the marriage rite.
Right.
What I heard
is they were moving so efficiently, actually. And you're right. They did do a pretty amazing job of running something that could have been, I mean, one wedding is chaos.
Yes, exactly.
But I think they opened up some slots because they were moving so efficiently, and that's probably where you got the uneven number.
But don't you think that city officials, I mean, there's so many things that you have to deal with when you're in government, like cutting budgets and viruses infecting your city and bus tunnel breakdowns and seawalls. Isn't it kind of nice to just celebrate love?
Well, it is. And as we talked about last week, it's more than love. It's, this is the most significant civil rights legislation that has passed in this state since the 1960s, really, or 1970s, certainly. And I think it's just really good to have that focus in terms of saying, this is a civil issue and we're going to celebrate it in a civil way. And I just thought that was really important and a very smart thing to do.
I think all the public officials who were involved, from County Executive Dow Constantine opening up the registration at midnight, he said he'd had an hour of sleep, to Mike McGinn, who opened up City Hall. I think there was this sense of, we are part of history and we shall do it in a graceful way. There's no understating how much a moment of history this was, and so many people sort of rallied to take part in that, including our elected officials.
Well, the other thing, Eli, you mentioned the sort of reception on the stairs, and we did a call-in about this on Monday, and the thing that really got to me were the number of people who weren't getting married, who were straight or single or nothing, who wanted to be part of it, who came and stood on the stairs.
Yeah, that was really moving, and there was one woman who came and showed up and held a sign that just said, "Sorry this took so long. Congratulations, and sorry this took so long." And that was also one of the elements that I tried to work into the piece that I wrote in The Stranger. Just this, we have the sense of the gay marriage fight being like a decade old or something, because it has really heated up in a serious way in the last decade. But there's a couple that showed up in the King County Marriage License Office asking for a license in 1971. And launched, as a result of their denial, one of the first gay marriage lawsuits ever seen in this country. And so there is a lot of history to this and a lot of history right here in Washington State. And this is a fight that has been going on for more than 40 years.
Joni, how many hits on those photos that you guys ran?
I mean, I don't have the numbers, but they were just sizable. And you just could tell, the photos were the writing too, but the photos really captured just the joy that people were feeling. And I do think it's amazing. All you think of is that movie about the wedding planner. Imagine for one wedding, the swans, the snow, the whole bit. And, this is just amazing that this happened. And so people were very interested. They flocked to those photos.
All right, I'm now going to depart from happy news for just a minute to let you know that the latest Connecticut officials are holding a press conference as we speak, and they're reporting that 18 children were killed in that shooting this morning. A total of, they think, 27 people. I'm seeing different numbers. So NPR will have more on that. We're going to have more on that. We're going to talk more about politics as well. So if you want to sort of just keep something in your heart, happy news is good. Hold on to that. We're talking about the week's news with Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, Knut Berger, and you at our email is weekday@kuow.org.
Sometimes to look forward, you got to look back a little bit, like to when unions came to Michigan.
Oh, that was an exciting time. My dad called one night and said, "Ida, we're on strike. I'll be home when it's over." And he was, in 44 days.
I'm Kai Rizdal. How Right to Work became a reality in Michigan. Next time on Marketplace from APN.
That story and much more coming up tonight at 6:30. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. It's 10:19.
Support for KUOW comes from TIAA CREF, helping people pursue their financial goals. Learn more at tiaacref.org/WA.
Clouds and light rain, 43 degrees in the University District. We're expecting rain this morning, tapering off to just a chance of rain later today, the high in the low 40s. Cloudy tonight, the low in the upper 30s. It's going to be cloudy, rainy, and breezy tomorrow, the high in the low 40s.
This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle. A shooting at a Connecticut elementary school today has left 27 people dead, including 18 children, according to a Connecticut official. The official spoke on condition of anonymity because the investigation is still underway. The gunman at Sandy Hook Elementary in Newtown, Connecticut, was killed. Apparently, he had two guns. So we'll have more details on that story as they unfold. The Connecticut officials are holding, as I understand, in a news conference as we speak, and NPR is on that, and we'll have more for you when we have it. Right now, we're talking over less horrific news with Knute Berger, Joni Balter, and Eli Sanders, our regular Friday panel. Our phone number, if you'd like to weigh in on some of the things that have been going on, whether it's today's shooting or the shooting earlier this week in Oregon, or same-sex marriage, something that lifts you up just a little bit, or at least lifts me up, I'll admit, 206-543-5869. Interesting news on Tuesday, I believe it was Tuesday, two Democratic state senators held a news conference to announce that they were going to create a new majority in the state Senate with their Republican friends. Rodney Thom of Medina, a relatively new Democrat, will become the Senate Majority Leader, and Tim Sheldon of Potlatch will be the Senate President pro tempore, pro tem, and that creates it's either a one-vote or a two-vote, one-vote majority for the Republican coalition. Randy Thom insists that he's still a Democrat, and he's expecting fellow conservatives to join with him. But Democrat Sid Snyder has said no way. And so we'll see what happens. Joni?
So Rodney Thom is a very interesting figure in the state Senate. Folks who know him know that he was a Republican in the House. And then in 2006, if that is the right year, I'm pretty sure I'm right, he decided to become a Democrat. He had talked about how the Republican Party in state government was too conservative for him. But Rodney, it may be one of those people who doesn't fit. It's possible who doesn't fit in a political party. Because last year in the spring, when the legislature was trying desperately to resolve its budget, there was this coup, if everybody remembers, late at night. And it was Rodney Thom and it was Jim Castema, who ran for Secretary of State this year. And it was it, who was the third one? Was it Sheldon? Yeah. And so they all decided to vote with the Republicans on the budget. And it was very, you know, sort of theatrical and, you know, stagey, but it did produce the budget. So now comes the Democrats gather a couple weeks ago and they elect Ed Murray as the Senate Majority Leader after Lisa Brown left. But that was only to hold for a minute or two there until this group, and I don't know if you call it a Republican coalition or they call themselves the Majority Coalition. Well, anyway, this shall be the governing, and they came up with these committees. They gave the sort of more powerful committees to Republicans, and then they gave lesser committees to Democrats to chair. So Ed Murray, who was obviously on the wrong end of this one, I saw him this week. He came in to talk, and he was saying generally that he would rather be in a true minority party part of the Senate rather than in this sort of quasi whatever this is. You know, it was an interesting take on him. I saw one writing of it that said, well, that way the Democrats don't have to be responsible for anything, i.e. they cannot be blamed for anything that's unpleasant. And legislatures lately do things that are sort of unpleasant. Mm-hmm. And so This is definitely an unusual coalition. Former Governor Dan Evans talked about a coalition that happened many years ago, much like this. His take was that maybe it'll reduce the chance of House Speaker Frank Chop being the alternate governor. So,
What do you think, Eli?
Well, I just want to grab onto one thing Joni said. There are different theories as to Rodney Thom's motivation. It could be that he is a very unique political character who can't be kept in any party's box and so has to jump back and forth between parties. Or alternate theory is he's an incredibly ambitious man who saw an opportunity here, who saw how narrowly the Senate was divided and saw that he could become Senate Majority Leader, not if he stayed with his own party, but if he defected to the Republicans and got Senate Majority Leader as the reward for going over and giving them majority. The other thing that Ed Murray will say is this is not done. that it seems like it may be, and you know, it very well may remain the reality when the legislature convenes in January, but the Democrats have not agreed to this yet. Now, I'm not sure
they don't need the Democrats.
I was going to say
to agree.
Yeah,
well,
they can go sit by themselves on the side there. You know.
Yeah, but they don't have to be in the coalition, the quote unquote coalition.
Yeah, that's true.
But were they planning on it? I didn't think they were. I mean,
no,
they were invited.
No, if they took those chairmanships that I referred to, then they were by. That's
right.
By it.
I see.
They
that's
could say,
right.
"No, this is a Republican." Led Senate, give those chairmanships to Republicans so that it's clear, as Ed Murray says, who's in charge here and who's to blame.
Right. And you know, they have to, Ed Murray and others have to make this judgment about, you know, is kind of, half a loaf worth taking, or do you just do you turn it down entirely? And there's some political advantages in letting the Republicans make a lot of the hard decisions mm-hmm. on the budget. The thing is, the table's been set in a bunch of interesting ways. First of all, even though the Democrats won, a near majority in the Senate, they a shaky majority in the Senate.
Very.
The new governor is coming in saying, I'm going to veto any tax increase. So, I mean, the table's been set both on the Democratic side and by the passage of the Iman initiative, which really hampers the legislature from raising revenues. And the budget, given increased spending in education that's mandated by the courts, and continued pressure on expenses, the budget's going to have to be ugly. I mean, they don't have the votes; they don't have the 2/3 votes to get the revenues raised.
Neither side has
right.
2/3.
So even if the Democrats were in charge, I mean, it would have been easier for them to craft a budget, but they still would have been crafting a budget that was under restrictions that would be unacceptable to a lot of people.
Well, there's money, but there are also the chairmanships of a education committee that's going to make a lot of policy decisions, and the healthcare committee, which is also in charge of what happens with the Affordable Care Act as it's implemented.
And those positions are this structure
go to the Republicans.
The Steve Lutzow, the moderate Republican from Mercer Island, and what's the name of the person? Is it Becker?
I think so.
Andy Becker.
So,
those are big. Those are big committees that where much of the budget money goes. They make a lot of policy. They decide what can be heard, what can't. And that education one had long been filled by Rosemary McAuliffe, who is sometimes viewed as a big pal of the union. So
I think one thing that we're finding is that that both in the Senate and the House, the Democrats have had some success in recruiting suburban moderates or conservatives and making them part of the coalition. As places like the East Side have gotten a little bit bluer, that's been easier. Mm-hmm. And you've had people switching from Republican to Democrat. But Rodney Thom said something, people sort of wear the partisan cloak lightly. Well, that's true where he comes from. That's true now on the East Side, is that there are liberal Republicans and conservative Democrats that are really hard to separate ideologically. But the advantage in terms of demographics is with the Democrats right now, and in the densest place where the most voters are. And so and I think maybe he's somewhat miscalculated in terms of the fact that When you take money from a party to get elected or help you with your election, and when you
said the magic words
when you take money from a party, that party's apparatus assists you, and then you go against your party's leadership in such a visible and significant way, and you come up with a system that even in the compromised version of his plan, you have somebody like Pam Roach, who's brought in, who is outcast from her own caucus, who's brought in and made a committee chairman.
Right.
And then you try to say this is about centrist politics and comedy in the legislature.
Not to be confused with comedy.
It doesn't pass. It doesn't. Well, it just yeah, well, exactly.
Perhaps on that. Committee.
Although, yeah.
But what I'm saying is that he's constructed a situation and trying to paint it as non-political or above politics. It reeks of politics, and it reeks of politics that people don't like. For the very reasons that Rodney Tom is ostensibly against, which is divisive approaches.
I got to laugh at the Pam Roach reference because actually, and I got one little crow for the Seattle Times here, is that actually Andrew Graber broke this story a couple weeks ago. It didn't get a lot of big, huge play because it wasn't certain. But during that time, I swear, I thought that Ed Murray would be courting Pam Roach for exactly the reason you were just talking about, because she's in play. She was gettable for the Democrats, and that is, they must have known that, Rodney Tom. The only other thing I wanted to add to the Rodney Tom discussion is I went doorbelling with Rodney Tom a few years back. Just, you know, one of those pieces that you write when you, you know,
right.
constituent reaction to a candidate. And while we were walking through his district, he said to me, you know, I'm really, really tight with money. So I said, how tight? And he said, well, I cut my hair and dry my hair with a Flowbee. I said, excuse me, what on earth is a Flowbee? Well, it's this gadget you attach, I'm not kidding, to your vacuum cleaner, and it cuts and styles your hair.
Seriously?
Oh, seriously. So I had to go back to the office, hurry up, go on Google, what the heck's a Flowbee? And I'm just trying to give you some insight here.
Well, I want to go back to the money when you take money from a political party, because Democratic Party Chair Dwight Pels was not happy, to say the least. And one thing he threw out there was, like, you know, we gave you, Mr. Tom, $18,000, I believe.
I thought it was $25,000.
$25,000 to run your campaign as a Democrat. So, you know, should he just give that money back? I think Dwight Pels would like it.
Yeah, I was wondering, has Dwight Pels demanded the money back?
I couldn't tell if he was being flip. You know, when you see it in print, you can't really tell what their tone is exactly. But, you know.
Always making the case for radio, aren't you?
Yeah, always.
The other thing that he took is votes. And, you know, it's fair enough. You're a representative. You represent your district to, you know, the best of your perception of what's right. But the people in Rodney Tom's district are not as middle of the road as he is presenting himself as. They voted. We ran these numbers. I think they voted something over 60% for Obama. So if he creates a situation in the legislature that makes it harder for us to enforce provisions of Obamacare or move forward on them, that's not what his district wants. They voted for Inslee. If he doesn't go along with the type of education reforms and budgeting that Inslee wants, that's not what his constituents voted for. And so, you know, he may end up with a problem with his own constituents as a result of this.
According to everything that I've read, and I haven't heard anything since, Jay Inslee was not, he wasn't attacking this or welcoming, and he was being really low key in his reception of this news.
Because there's not much he can do.
Yeah, and I'm sure that in a sense, Rodney Tom could be rationalizing this to himself, which is basically there are no huge social issues. Gay marriage is passed. There's no huge social issues that are going to be a problem this time. There are a fair number. If you add up the Democrats and the centrist Republicans who are pro-environment, you've got a reasonably good group of Greens in the Senate. You also have a Democratic governor. So really what has to happen is a really hard-nosed fiscal, getting to the weird vacuum cleaner hairdryer thing.
You want one, don't you? Tell me the truth.
Basically what has to happen on the fiscal side is you have to have decisions made in the short term by budget cutters. I mean, by people who are fiscally conservative. And in a sense, he's taking on the mantle of being the bad guy, because nobody really wants to have the budget slashed to the degree it's going to have to be slashed.
And just a last, because we're actually going to join the BBC in Progress right now, who's covering the shooting in Connecticut. But I just have to ask about Ed Murray, because in a way, right before all this came out, he was sort of waffling about his decision for his mayoral candidacy. wouldn't this make this a little bit easier for him to say, heck, I'm just going to be the mayor of Seattle?
Well, first of all, it's not so easy to become mayor. He still can't fundraise during that time. But maybe he has time to talk to people, not in a fundraising sense, since he's not running the Senate.
And personally, maybe it becomes a motivation. But I think politically, I mean, there's not a great logic for this, but people could say, oh, man, Ed, like you were supposed to, you know, put the Senate together in a way that benefited Democrats and it fell apart. Now, I don't think you can fairly blame that on him necessarily, but I think people might try.
Here's the flip side. The flip side is he could come out of the session saying, see that ugly budget? I mean, the budget they're going to pass, if it had to be passed with his name on it, would make him less popular in Seattle. And this way he can distance himself and say, look at Rodney Tom's budget. Isn't it ugly?
Yeah.
I'd never do that here in Seattle. So it gives him a little bit of a distance there.
Always, we've got a lot of months ahead of us to talk about the Seattle mayoral race. And I'd like to thank Joni Balter, who is associate editor. What are you, an editor?
Assistant political editor.
Your job changes all the time. Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger, and Knute Berger, editor at large of Seattle Magazine, and the Moss back at Crosscut. We'll be back to talk politics and more next week. Just again, updating you, a shooting at a Connecticut elementary school today has left 27 people dead, including 18 children. The worst school shooting in U.S. history, and we're joining the BBC in progress now.
Children, and that's several outlets now confirming it, but of course we are, reporting that, but of course we're waiting for confirmation from this press conference. In terms of the identity of the person responsible, what's being reported is, and as I say, this is not confirmed, is that it was a 20-year-old man who had ties to the school. There have been reports of a second gunman being involved, but again, that has not been confirmed. And there are also reports that two guns have been recovered at the scene. One official has been quoted as saying that there was a rifle recovered at the scene. But again, we're waiting for confirmation from that press conference. In terms of how events unfolded, it's very unclear what happened. There are reports that this incident began shortly after lessons started at that elementary school in the office of the school, and that it then progressed on to the kindergarten. What's extraordinary about this story really is the age of the children involved. It's an elementary school, so we're talking about children aged between 5 and 10. And that's really what makes this story just so shocking. I've been in Washington now reporting from here for the last 6 months, and this is now the third mass shooting that I've covered.
And we talked earlier on about the phrase that's being used in the CBS coverage of this. Andy Carvin has been tweeting about it as well. Apparently the phrase on CBS's coverage is people speculating whether this might be the worst school shooting in US history. Of course, we'll wait to see whether confirmation of the details from the police confirms that. I'm seeing in the latest copy from the Associated Press that this is indeed the latest of several mass shootings in the US this year. And they're saying it approaches the deadly scope of the Virginia Tech University shootings in 2007 that left 32 people dead. Well, we'll see what the police say when they do their news conference shortly. We're still waiting for that to happen. Thanks ever so much for the moment. Zoe Conway is helping us tell this story from the BBC's Bureau in Washington, D.C. I'm looking at various other reports and tweets. The Associated Press, again, is tweeting that the Connecticut school shooting suspect is a 20-year-old man with ties to the school, a law enforcement official says. Well, we still don't know that for sure. That's what the Associated Press is saying, and we'll see whether those reports are confirmed when the police speaks to the BBC and the rest of the media in a public news conference, which we are expecting. Thanks for the moment, Zoe Conway. I'm looking at various pieces of reaction that are coming in from you and other people who are tweeting about this around the world. Matt in Wisconsin tweets, I just want to hug every person who matters in my life right now. This world is out of control. he says, and lots of you are getting in touch to express shock. David Levy says, devastating is the only word to describe the news from Sandy Hook Elementary. Terrifying for anyone with small children. Melissa's been in touch from San Diego saying, anyone else fighting the urge to go and pick your kids up from school right now? Let's have a look at some more of the reaction that you're sending us, and people are tweeting about this. We can see in Australia, Indonesia, China, Argentina and Chile, and we can still see that Pray for Newtown is trending worldwide, the hashtag that's at the top of the worldwide trending topics. It's something that's occupying a lot of people's minds online at the moment. Newtown, Connecticut, 27 dead and 18 children are also topics that are being trended. But again, I have to say that those figures are yet to be confirmed by the BBC. Stephen Dedis is tweeting, saying, sick to my stomach after seeing the horrific updates from Sandy Hook. Everybody call your parents today. He says, Mickey Ryan is on Twitter talking about this as well. Just shocked and saddened by reports of the Newtown shooting. Every parent's nightmare. I'm going to hug the stuffing out of my daughter tonight. And by the way, if you want to look at this story in more detail through this programme, but then beyond, as we go off air, you can do that on a BBC Live page that's now up at bbc.com/news, where we're pulling together the latest reports, the latest comments, all into one stream, so you can check on the latest updates on this story. I'm seeing on that live page that US President Barack Obama has been informed of the incident and is receiving regular updates. That's from his press secretary, Jay Carney. President Obama has spoken to the state's governor and expressed his condolences to those who've lost loved ones. I'm also reading from Paul Adams, who's a BBC News correspondent in Washington. He's saying that for some time, the apparent lack of panic outside the school led networks to report that the death toll was low, including the gunman and members of staff. But over the past hour, an altogether more horrific picture has emerged. With the police still sweeping the school, there are reports that an entire class, possibly a kindergarten, remains unaccounted for. Well, that's an unconfirmed report, but we'll see if that comes to pass when the police do speak. And, well, it looks like we are expecting a news conference. It looks like it could happen any moment now. I can see people who are approaching the microphone, so it could be that we're about to hear something from officials, and we will go straight to that as soon as it does happen. Just to recap the details, we know as many as 27 people have been killed, including children, in a shooting attack at a Connecticut primary school. We don't know for sure the numbers yet. These are just local media reports that are yet to be confirmed by the BBC. Let's go to the news conference now. It's about to start live from Newtown.
Talk a little bit about what's known so far. We understand that you are all interested in information. We'd like to get you that information as quickly as possible. But the governor's chief concern is making sure that the families have information as quickly as possible. And that's where he is now. This is Lieutenant Paul Vance from the State Police.
Hi, good afternoon. I will give you some very basic and brief information as we know it now, and we will set up regular press briefings as appropriate. Just after 9:30 this morning, Newtown Police received a 911 call for an emergency at the elementary school. Newtown PD, upon obtaining information as to the statue of the situation, contacted the Connecticut State Police and requested assistance from State Police and surrounding local police departments. On and off-duty troopers responded to the school, and with Newtown Police, immediately upon arrival, entered the school and began a complete active shooter search of the building. That included checking every door, every crack, every crevice, every portion of that school. Our main objective was to evacuate as quickly and efficiently as possible any and all students and faculty in the school. The entire school was searched. That was accomplished. A staging area was set up. The students and staff were put into that staging area, and soon thereafter, the children were and staff were reunited with their parents and their loved ones. There were several fatalities at the scene, both students and staff. There is no information relative to that that is being released at this time until we've made complete and proper notification. The shooter is deceased inside the building. There's a great deal of work that is undertaken immediately upon locating the shooter, and that is there's a great deal of search warrant activity, there's a great deal of law enforcement activity both in and out of state to ensure that we cover all the bases relative to that specific individual. Suffice it to say, the scene is secure. State Police Major Crime Squad, Newtown Police Department, Danbury State's Attorney and many agencies are working together to answer all the questions surrounding exactly what happened. As Mr. Ochoa-Grosio said, we will keep you briefed, we will keep you informed on a regular basis. We will put everything out via our website and with these press conferences. I'll turn it back over to Mr. Ochoa-Grosio right now.
The governor took a call from President Obama a little while ago, who was calling to express his condolences and condolences on behalf of the nation, and pledged whatever resources the federal government can bring to bear to assist the families and to assist in the investigation. We will get you information as soon as we can get the families the information. That's where the governor is. At some point later today, the governor will be here, and we will set up regular briefings. Thank you.
Are all those briefings going to be here?
Again, no questions at this time. I apologize. We will not be able to answer any questions. As I said, the scene is secure. The situation is secure. We will notify you shortly when we will come back for another briefing. As quickly as we can.
But you can say that the public is not in danger.
The public is not in danger, that's correct.
Hey, Lieutenant, everything here, right? All the briefings here?
Right here.
How many fatalities are there?
Well, that's Lieutenant Paul Vance from the Connecticut State Police. And we also heard the Governor of Connecticut's senior advisor, Roy Ochoa-Grosio, speaking to reporters there. You could hear from the reporters that thirst for extra information, but the priority, said Lieutenant Vance, is getting the information to the family, quite understandably, before it, or the families, I should say, quite understandably, before it's released to reporters and the media. Let's go over some of the key points from that news conference. Lieutenant Paul Vance said that just after 9:30 this morning, local time, the Newtown Police received a 911 call. That's around about, what, 4 hours or so ago. Immediately they got information, assistance from other agencies. You heard him describe how the Newtown Police entered the school and they searched every crack, every crevice, he said, and they established a staging area to evacuate the children, which was their priority. He talked of several fatalities at the scene, both students and staff, but they were not releasing any information relative to the size of the number of people dead. He did say that the shooter is deceased inside the building. He also said that there's a great deal of search warrant activity both inside and outside of the state. And one of the key points as well was that the scene is now secure and the public there is not in danger. So that's as much as we have from the police. We also heard from the governor's spokesperson, Roy Ochoa-Grosio, reiterating that the governor had spoken to President Obama and that he, the governor, is with the families at the moment and helping get the information to them. Let's hear now somebody speaking to reporters called Richard Wilford. His son is in school in the town of Newtown, but not in the one affected by this incident.
There's no words that there's no words that I could come up with that would even come close to describing the sheer terror of hearing that your son is in a place or your child is in a place where there's been violence. You don't know the details of that violence. You don't know the condition of your child, and you can't do anything to immediately help them or protect them. It is a powerless and terrifying experience.
And to clarify, his son was in the school affected, but the son himself was not affected by the violence and he has found safety, which is good news for him. Now, I'm looking at the Twitter comments and the emails that you're sending in. Isaac's been in touch from New York on email. Even in a state like Connecticut, which is said to have strong gun legislation compared to the rest of the United States, individuals are allowed to have guns. Until we change this, we'll continue to hear such stories. It's time to do something about it. Well, Isaac, that's a debate that we had as the Colorado shooting unfolded as well. And no doubt it's a debate that will continue online as people hear more details of this latest incident. Christine is also tweeting on a similar theme. Gun control now, she says, Newtown shooting. Do we need another tragedy to see that there are too many guns in this country in the wrong hands? Caitlin has tweeted from Texas. My heart goes out to the people in Connecticut. This is a sad day. and using the hashtags that many people are using, Newtown Shooting and Sandy Hook. James got in touch on Twitter as well. As an American who lived in the UK for most of his life, I believe the US should apply the same gun laws as the UK. Well, we'll certainly come back to that debate, I'm sure, and it's one that is inevitable in terms of this story, I'm sure, and something that has been a response to other stories that we've done and other conversations that we've had in the wake of other incidents like this. Let's just recap the details as we know them. As many as 27 people have been killed at this shooting at a primary school in Connecticut. The numbers, though, are not confirmed so far. You heard in the last few minutes Lieutenant Paul Vance from the State Police in Connecticut saying that the priority is getting information to the families and they're not going to be releasing any information in terms of the numbers to media until the families have been fully informed. What he did say, though, that were several fatalities at the scene, both students and staff. And as this is an elementary school, the students are likely to be in the range of 5 to 10 years old. That's the sort of age of children that go to such a school in the United States. At least a dozen children, some media are reporting, are among the dead at this school. The gunman has been killed as well. The shooter is deceased inside the building, were the precise words of the Lieutenant Paul Vance from the State Police, who was giving that news conference alongside the governor's spokesman. Clam has been in touch on our Facebook page. I live about half an hour away. It's unsettling, too close to home. Eric says on Facebook, I live about 20 minutes from the school. Horrible. Awful. Pray for all involved. Governor Malloy is going to speak shortly. Well, we heard from his senior advisor there, Eric, that he is going to speak as soon as he's dealt with the families. And I think that is where he is now. Let's hear from a mother and daughter who've been speaking to media about this.
There was a masked man came in and just started shooting. So I don't know how he came in, because every time you go in, you have to ring a bell and they can see you from the office. And they know who you are and they let you in. So I don't know if it's somebody they knew.
When we were gone doing morning meeting, we heard like shots and everybody went on the ground and Miss Martin just closed the door and we went to the corner.
So that's a mum and daughter. We heard that clip before as well. They're describing some of what they see, what they saw and what they heard as this incident unfolded around about 9:30 or so in the morning, according to the police. That's when the 911 call was received from this elementary school. And that's when the police sprung into action to enter the school. They were talking about the search that they conducted and the school is now secure. The public are no longer in any danger. Veronica has been in touch from Amman on our Facebook page. So sad, she says, and can't understand why people are doing that. Innocent children being killed. It's painful to lose people that you love. I'm looking at the BBC Live page, which is covering this story. BBC.com/news is where you'll find that. And it's been relaying some of the details from that news conference. The governor is meeting the families at the moment in Connecticut, and he says that he's horrified to hear the stories that he's hearing, and it's likely we'll hear from Governor Dan Malloy at some point shortly. That was according to his spokesperson at the news conference alongside the police. We can see tweets now from Kenya, from Nigeria, from Namibia, South Africa, Senegal and Iran talking about this story. Brittany Hardy's been in touch to say, my heart's aching for those families who lost children today. Why would anyone want to kill a child? I can't even imagine. Carlo has been on Twitter to react to some of the images that he's seeing in the news coverage of this shooting. He says, the image I'm seeing of what looks like a young mum in anguish on a cell phone is ripping my heart out. And a number of the other images that people have been reacting to include the sight of very distressed children being led across a car park at that school to safety. I'm looking at some of the major news networks now, BBC World News, Sky News, CNN and others rolling on this story. We're seeing aerial views of this school. It's a school, according to the BBC's Paul Adams, which is home to some 600 students. And he's talking about eyewitnesses hearing as many as 100 shots shortly after 9:30 in the morning in his latest dispatch on this story. He says that frightened children between 5 and 10 years of age were seen running from the buildings. And for several hours, all schools in the area were locked down as hospitals started to receive the wounded. And that's something we heard from parents who've been in touch with the BBC, who have children not at this particular school, but at other schools close by. That's what they were saying, that their children were locked down and kept safe while the police secured Sandy Hook Elementary School and while they sorted out the situation there. And so the children could be led to safety and they could be confident that the shooter was no longer active. Phil has emailed us from Nottingham saying this is simply awful and tragic. The horror faced by those involved and their families is unimaginable and no words can lessen the pain suffered. Our thoughts are with all of you. Chris Ayres has got in touch on Twitter. Heard the news at the airport. You saw the parents just hold their kids a little closer. So unbelievably sad. Thoughts go out to all. And it does seem that the thing that many of you are reacting to the most about this particular shooting is the fact that such young children are involved. As I said, an elementary school, a primary school, that some of you may know that as, where children who are under the age of 10 are involved. And it certainly seems to be something many of you are reacting to. You're listening to World Have Your Say on the BBC. We're spending this hour responding to a breaking story of a shooting at an elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut. This is around 80 miles or so from New York City in the west of that state. It seems that as many as 27 people may have been killed in this incident, including children, at least a dozen, according to some media reports. We're still to get an official figure on the number of people who've been killed and injured. The police were saying at a news conference just a few minutes ago that we brought to you live on World Have Your Say that they're yet to confirm those details to the media because they're informing the parents and the families of those involved first before they make that information public. Many of you getting in touch to respond to the story. Bill in Seattle, someone who's emailed us, and once again someone who wants to talk about the gun control issue, which is how a number of people are responding to this. He says maybe it's time for the USA to consider an end to gun-free zones. They don't work, he says. Allow responsible individuals at our schools to be the guardians of our children that we expect them to be. Trevor has got in touch on Twitter using the hashtag WHYS. Love and support to students, staff and families of victims. I read you a comment earlier on from somebody called Christian who lives in the nearby town of Trumbull, Connecticut. We've now got Christian on the phone. Hi there, Christian. Welcome to the programme.
Hello.
You're a teacher in a town nearby. How do you respond to this story that's unfolding?
It's horrifying and terrifying, obviously. My thoughts and prayers go out to everybody in Newtown who's affected by this personally. It's scary enough for the rest of us, and I can only imagine what it's like for them. I have a friend whose wife is a teacher in the school, and I found out a little while ago that she's fine and she was able to keep her class safe, so I'm happy about that. But it's scary. You think you're safe. You think we're in Connecticut. We're not in Colorado. We're not in Texas. This isn't going to happen here. But as we just saw, it can happen here.
And that's interesting because I think a number of people, when they get in touch around the world about the United States and about gun control, perhaps don't perceive the differences that you see locally in the differences between different parts of the United States. Just tell us a bit more about that. You feel safer in your part of the states than in other places.
Well, gun control is tighter up here. We're in the Northeast, and gun control is tighter. We don't have nearly the number of people carrying guns as you do in other parts of the country. Schools are supposed to be gun-free zones. That you're not supposed to have a gun within 100 feet of the building.
Yeah.
It shouldn't even be an issue. But as we can see, it can be. And then you go online and you see people commenting that we should arm teachers. And as a teacher, I just want to say that's the last thing in the world that we need right now is guns in a school. That's just an awful idea.
And what did your friend's wife say about how things unfolded and how she got to safety?
All I've heard is that she's actually the art teacher, and she was able to get all of her kids and herself into the kiln room, which is attached to her room, and she can lock that from the inside. So she was able to keep all the kids in there and herself in there, and they were safe. Everything that was happening was out in the hallway, so they weren't affected directly. She was kept safe. She didn't see any of it, which is probably better.
And I believe you're a teacher yourself at a school nearby.
Yeah.
Describe how the news spread in your own school and what happened around you.
Well, we got an email probably an hour after it happened. I had heard already because my friend's wife was there. That was the only reason I had already heard about it. But we got an email probably about an hour after it happened, just notifying us and telling us that, you know, carry on with our day as it was supposed to be, but just be aware of what was going on nearby.
Christian, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us on World Have Your Say. We appreciate it. I can see that the CBS News correspondent Bob Orr has just been quoted on that organisation's Twitter feed saying the body language of officials seems to point in the direction of a single gunman based on preliminary information. Well, that's not confirmed yet, but to keep in touch with all the latest details and developments in this unfolding story, go to the live page at bbc.com/news.
Good morning, it's 10:59. Our live coverage of today's elementary school shooting in Connecticut continues in 60 seconds. We'll join NPR for their live coverage. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services, a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington.
Support for KUOW comes from Edible Seattle magazine, celebrating local foods and food culture. Gift subscriptions available in time for holiday giving, with 6 issues arriving annually. Available at Metropolitan Market, Whole Foods, and online at edibleseattle.com.
Clouds and rain, 43 degrees in the University District. We're expecting rain the rest of this morning, tapering off to just a chance of rain later today, the high in the low 40s. It's going to be cloudy tonight, the low in the upper 30s, cloudy, rainy, and breezy tomorrow, the high in the low 40s.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.